All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast, the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian, anarcho-capitalist perspective. That's what we do here on episode 192 of the show, and we're going to be talking about the Adam Sandler flick Uncut Gems. It's the second Adam Sandler movie that we've done on this show, the first one being Billy Madison. Will this one stack up? We will see. We'll go down to Robert and check. What is your take on whether this movie will be as entertaining or as fun of a discussion, especially with our guest who we'll introduce in the last night's portion of the show, as Billy Madison was when we did that one a few years ago?
Billy Madison was just some nostalgia fest talking about, wasn't it funny when he said this and wasn't it funny when he said that, and I grew up watching this. It's a terrible film, but it was funny for a 14-year-old, 15-year-old, 16-year-old audience, and that's what that was. This is actually an adult film with adult actors doing adult acting things, with actually like a script and a director, and they weren't just making it up on the spot, and there's no like 2-minute music video in the middle of it for no reason. So yeah, I think this is actually a film that you might want to go and watch and then talk about and discuss in a hopefully interesting intellectual way. Well, quasi-intellectual, considering the participants.
Yeah, present company included. But our guest is actually going to bring, I think, a lot more to it. Similar to how Hamilton, if it was just us knuckleheads, it wouldn't have been a very good show. But because we had Tho on, he brought a lot of knowledge about Hamilton's history to the discussion of Hamilton the musical. And we've, of course, reaffirmed our thoughts that we are not musical inclined dudes. So anyway, we should get into the last nighter's portion of the show and introduce our guest right after these massages. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Paul Johnson, and we are the Last Nighters. You can find us on the Launchpad Media, where they're always launching new ideas in your direction. Tonight is actually episode 135 of the show. I know last week I kept saying that show was 135, but that was actually 134. We talked about Hamilton with Tho Bishop of the Mises Institute. Tonight, we're going to be talking about Uncut Gems, the Adam Sandler movie, as episode 135 of the Last Nighters. And we're going to have a great guest who I'll introduce in just a moment. But you can support us over on Patreon. Go to lastnighters.com/Patreon. We've got a couple of really cool things coming up that we're going to be offering to our Patreon people. One of the things is being able to watch live streams like this as we're making the sausage. But there's a new feature that's coming out on a service called Movies Anywhere that allows us to watch a movie with up to 8 different people at the same time. So it's something I'm going to try out. So I think if you're one of our Patreons, we'll schedule a time to do that, and we can all watch a movie together. And maybe Robert and I can do some kind of MSTK3 thing. I don't know. That might be above our skill set, so we'll see. But check it out, lastnighters.com/Patreon for that and more. And tonight, we're here to talk about the Adam Sandler movie. It's a serious Adam Sandler movie. We did Billy Madison a couple of years ago, and tonight is similar in vein to the Punch Drunk Love version of Adam Sandler, where he's actually taking a serious tone. And it starts with a hole in his butt and ends with a hole in his head. It's Uncut Gems, and we're going to be talking with our pal Pat McFarlane of Liberty Weekly. He's going to join us to talk about this movie, about gambling addiction, the NBA playoffs, and precious gemstones on tonight's episode. So you can find his work over at libertyweekly.net. He's been on the show with us many, many times in the past. He's a good friend of ours. His most recent appearance was for American Psycho, which was back at, I think, the end of May, perhaps early June, something like that. Things are fuzzy during lockdown times. I've lost all concept of time, but welcome back to the show, Pat. We really enjoy having you here.
Hey, thanks, guys. I really love being here with you guys. And now that my show is still on hiatus, which I've been wanting to come back, I've really been wanting to come back. So believe me there. It's really good to jump into this sphere and then be able to jump out maybe without commitments. Because I feel like once I get the ball rolling, I need to keep it rolling. But I am a attorney. I've been practicing for about 2 years. I practice in personal injury and civil rights law on the plaintiff's side. So the good guys, right? But you can find my work at libertyweekly.net. I had a podcast I really, really enjoy working on, and I've kept it alive in the hosting realm throughout this whole time, and with support from my very generous patrons, whom I love very much and who are somewhat neglected, but I will get back to you. I love you. But just glad to join you for the show, and I'm really excited to hear your take on Uncut Gems. I really like this movie, so let's get rolling.
All right, well, very good, and we will get rolling with the Google description, which is how we usually fire this thing off. So, without further ado, this is, of course, Uncut Gems, came out last year, 2019. It's a crime-slash-dark comedy film, 2 hours and 15 minutes, according to Google. Rated R! 7.4 IMDb, 92% Rotten Tomatoes, 90% Metacritic, and only 70% of Google users liked it. It's currently available on Netflix. That's where Robert and I both watched it. And the description reads, a charismatic jeweler makes a high-stakes bet that could lead to the windfall of a lifetime. In a precarious high-wire act, he must balance business, family, and adversaries on all sides in pursuit of the ultimate win. Came out on Christmas of last year. Kind of a weird Christmas movie. The directors are Josh and Benny Safdie. Not sure if I'm saying the name right. Came in with a box office of $50 million. Won or was nominated for Independent Spirit Award for Best Feature. And won an Independent Spirit Award for Best Male Lead. Adam Sandler, of all people. It also features Kevin Garnett, Julia Fox, Idina Menzel, and a few other folks. One critic's review says it's entertaining, but not in any traditional or even non-traditional sense of the word. So, Robert, I will go to you for your opening take on this film.
Well, it is refreshing to see Adam Sandler back in a serious role. I understand that he didn't want to take the role because he was worried about the view that it's like this kind of greedy Jew character, and it's like, should I play this? Is it playing into the stereotype or is it not? And ultimately, he went and did it, and I wouldn't necessarily say he's greedy. I would say that he has incredibly high time preference, and he is just this degenerate gambler guy. Like the idea and the concept of saving some money up so that he can place a bet on something is like totally foreign to him. If he has in his greedy little hands, I said the word greedy, oh well. If he's got in his hands any kind of object that's of any value, even if it's not his, he's going to hawk it and then play some crazy bet. And maybe he's a good gambler, maybe he's not, but it's just bizarre that he is even alive at the beginning of this movie. I would think that somebody would have been fed up with him and killed him long ago if this is his normal behavior. The description says he's charismatic, and I don't know about that. I found him very unpleasant. I found his relationship with his girlfriend to be very unrealistic, other than maybe that he's got some money. But I don't see his like attractive qualities. And I have a relationship with his wife to be very, very realistic, on the other hand, where she just hates the guy and he's sick of his crap. But overall, it's a very entertaining film. It's very non-traditional. It doesn't have like a traditional kind of hero's journey or anything like that. It's basically the story of his high wheeling, dealing, gambling ways finally catching up with him. Okay, and that's why I prefer Adam Sandler does pornos. Pat?
Well, Adam Sandler's pornos are definitely... No, I found this trope to be true in terms of Adam Sandler, and my mom, of all people, absolutely despises Adam Sandler. And my wife and I actually had a discussion about this after we first saw this movie, is that Adam Sandler, and I think this must be a trope of his films, is that Adam Sandler is admittedly a very kind of unattractive, somewhat charismatic, controversially charismatic person. But in all of his films, he always ends up getting the girl. And often these girls are very attractive and definitely not in his league. And it's a quality that I know at least the women in my life don't appreciate because, you know, maybe he's a great guy. I don't know. But he doesn't seem like it often sometimes in his movies. But he always ends up with a girl, and I guess they get annoyed with that for some reason. So it's interesting. Yeah,
I can see that. Though I would say that his older movies back when I was growing up, and it was more raunch comedies that he was just making movies with his friends because he could. And it's like, you know, he was famous enough to be able to do it and pull it off. And he made two classics, Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore. But back in those.
And The Wedding Singer?
I think that's a lesser movie between
really?
Those two.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
We can get into that maybe if you want to turn this into Adam Sandler.
Yeah, Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore are equal high marks that I think were back to back. And then it was a downward slope from there. A couple of, you know, ups and downs. But I don't think anything he's done since has reached the greatness that either of those films are.
Well, I guess you fuckers lived through it. I was a wee child.
To call those movies films is a bit of a stretch.
They made 90 minutes, all right? So that's all it takes. But my point is, in those movies, he wasn't like, he was a goofy acting guy, but he wasn't like a goofy looking guy. Whereas his more recent stuff, he's more banked on his awkwardness and his like goofy. I mean, they even explicitly call this out when he tries to make amends with his wife in this, and she's looking at him. And she's like, I just can't look at you and take you seriously. You're just so fucking ridiculous looking, you know? And so I think you're right in the point that he ends up with the girl in the present day movies because he looks goofy as fuck. But in the older movies, it was like he acted goofy as fuck. So like he was so childish in Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore, but he still ended up with the girl in either, you know, in both of those movies. But I think for different reasons.
Yeah, it was kind of endearing then, maybe a little bit, where some women could see that as being endearing and cute. Yeah. What about Eddie Murphy? I mean, you know, in Eddie Murphy's later catalog, he's kind of taken the same arc, don't you think?
Well, since I haven't seen an
Eddie Murphy has a later catalog?
Since Metro.
Norbit. Have you seen Norbit? This is actually a family film.
No.
Family.
No.
Relationship. He got
I will not see that
because it was super racist and problematic. We should do that. We should make
really.
It
we should watch Norbit.
Yeah. Have you heard of this show?
I have heard of Norbit, and I recall you making
a comment about
mention of it. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Sorry, I'll let you guys take over.
Now, isn't one of the things in Norbit he does the same thing that he does in what is it, Dr. Doolittle, where he plays multiple characters?
Yeah, and the Nutty Professor. And
yeah.
So he plays like three or four characters in it. It's pretty funny.
Okay, I'm not sure how we got to Eddie Murphy from Adam Sandler, but that's okay.
They have similar career arcs. That's it. So Uncut Gems.
So there's a couple of things that I just had in my notes related to this, and that's because Sandler works in the Diamond District of New York. And he seems to be doing fairly well. He has like a high-end clientele. He's got a business associate that he works with who like is kind of like, what's the right word? But he's bringing in these big fish, and he gives him a cut, like a commission for bringing in these.
And he's a finder.
Yeah, like a finder's fee. He's got ins in different groups and whatnot, and he brings in like NBA stars and whatnot. And it seems like a very like up-and-up, you know, relationship. And I was wondering if you guys thought that, you know, the old leftist trope that advertising like manipulates people to buy things they don't actually need, and thus you're being exploited or taken advantage of. Do you think that they would view this scenario similarly, where this guy is bringing in people like Kevin Garnett or other basketball players who are really good at basketball and they have a lot of money, but he's sort of taking advantage of their desire to be blingy or whatever, you know, whatever the thing is to be showy. Do you think that I'm not asking if you think that this is a bad thing. I think it's totally like, hey, if he wants it and he's got it, the other guy's got it and they're willing to make an exchange, that's totally fine. But do you think that someone from that other persuasion would view this as an exploitation of a Kevin Garnett by the Adam Sandler character.
Well, I think
that, Robert.
I think that, hopefully I'm not garbling up, but I got to be impressed with the diamond industry as a whole, that they have created this industry out of, you know, shiny rocks, that they have made it so that, you know, the successful marketing campaigns have convinced people that you got to, you know, have a diamond for a wedding engagement band, and
two
that they
salary.
Are right. 2 months salary. You it's ridiculous, but you've convinced people, enough people, that these things are desirable and that you got to do it because this is the only way to express your love. That this is, you have to do this way because and the bigger, the better. Right. I wouldn't say it's exploitative, of course, but it is impressive to invent an industry and invent a market demand for a product that has no other necessarily like industrial uses. I mean, I guess you could use them for glass cutters and I mean, I'm sure their diamonds have uses, but to essentially invent this entire industry on a non-functional, I mean, other than like you say, bling, you know, and so that people can show off, ooh, look at what I got. Look at this rock that my husband gave me, that kind of thing. I'd say it's just impressive. I don't really know other way to say it. I wouldn't say that it's exploitative.
Yeah, but do you think that somebody who looks at a scenario where advertising bad, getting you to buy something that you wouldn't otherwise buy, something unnecessary, right? It's the
well, people do that
paradox.
All the time, though. I mean, people buy like the ShamWow and they buy like OxyClean. And I mean, I don't know. That's the entire late night advertising industry. Is buying shit you don't need.
Right, right. But it's kind of the Galbraithian thing where you're being convinced or manipulated into doing so. And in this microcosm of the movie, it's these rich athletes who have money to burn and are seeking to have status symbols. And so then you've got a guy like Adam Sandler's character out here providing that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that somebody who's of the woke persuasion would view that as an exploitative relationship?
I think that they would probably, yeah. They would be seeing that you're convincing them somehow through your mysterious evil ways that you are going to manipulate this person into thinking that he needs this thing, and that clearly he's this superstitious person or something, and that this rock has magical powers and it's going to help him with his basketball game, or it's going to impress his friends with the magic bling or whatever. I could see them concocting some sort of a story in that vein, but it's hard for them to paint the multi-millionaire as the victim in this case, but I don't know, maybe.
Right, and if anything, he ends up underpaying for it, right?
Yeah.
What do you got, Pat?
Well, I don't think it'd be hard to paint the multimillionaire as a victim because you just go back to what do the NBA owners make compared to what the players make in terms of their salary for playing the actual game. I mean, the owners make a crap load of money. This is something that's, I mean, I pay some attention to sports, but at the end of the day, the players really, a lot of people think they're overpaid, but at the end of the day, the players make a lot less money than the owners do and everything, the merchandisers that surround it all. And I just watched that. This is funny how this plays into it, but I just watched that Michael Jordan, the Last Dance on Netflix as well. Maybe we should do a series on that. Probably not applicable. But he made all of his money from advertising, not from playing basketball. I think he was actually underpaid, and Scottie Pippen was really underpaid, woefully underpaid. So that's the angle they would take, you know. KG, I guess KG doesn't get a whole lot of money from this, but...
But they're in the open market, though. They could sell their skills to anybody they wish. I mean, I'm sure he's at that very peak of his game. There must be he's the player with the highest demand on the planet. So if the NBA is underpaying him, wouldn't you think that there would be some other organization that looks like, oh, there's some value I can get there, and I can offer him some more money and still make plenty of money?
But who has more money than the NBA?
China.
Well, the thing about the NBA is that they have a cap, a salary cap for a team. And if you go over the cap, then you pay penalties. And if you're over the cap in multiple years, then you pay double penalties. And so a lot of star players will take less money so that there's additional funds under the cap to be able to get complimentary pieces to teammates that fill
Absolutely.
Out the roster.
Yeah, yeah. So they'll take a pay cut to win a championship. Yeah, they do it all the time because right. they value the championship because the money, like, right, the more you have of it, the less each dollar means to you. So if you're already a multi-millionaire and you'd rather win the championship than make an extra few bucks.
Right. And then you want to play in a Texas or a Florida team because there's no state income tax.
State income. Yeah.
Let's go to Miami, baby.
Well, so make to push back, so something that Robert said was like, well, buying things that you don't need, right? Well, that's such a subjective judgment. You know, it. How do you know that Kevin Garnett doesn't need, how important is it for his career? He needs status symbols. I mean, you're in a business that's all about status. If you have higher status, maybe then you get more endorsements from shoe designers or something like that. You know, this whole determination, and this is exactly what determines value in the first place, is this subjective determination of what something is worth, whatever someone is willing to pay for it. So maybe that would be the counter to what maybe leftists would criticize about this film or this situation, or creating this entire market. But to defend this market in of itself, I wanted to push back on something Robert said. Basically, like, this market wasn't created. I mean, as far back as you go in the history of when mankind emerged from apes, one of the first things that we noticed was that they started adorning themselves with jewelry. So to say that this market is entirely created, I don't think is even accurate.
Well, in my defense, I meant specifically for diamonds.
Right.
Like, and, I was talking about the industrial uses.
I see.
Yeah. Go ahead.
But there's also the De Beers government-sanctioned cartel that I'd have to do some research into this and maybe post something in the show notes page at lastnerds.com/135 about De Beers and the ability, because the government did not permit additional competitors into the marketplace, that they were able to reduce the supply and thus drive up the price due to the scarcity of the diamonds that they were mining. And there's also the water diamond paradox, which is also very famous because water is very valuable. It's necessary for life, yet it's had for a pittance normally, whereas diamonds have very little utility, like you were saying, Robert, yet they go for a very high value. And what that doesn't take into account is like the time and place of where it is. Like if you're in a desert and there's no water to be found, you're willing to pay a very high price for that water. Whereas if you're in the lap of luxury, water's totally abundant and you're a rich NBA player, then certain things are more important to you, like status. And so a diamond will be far more valuable to you subjectively. And the other thing related to this movie is this is in 2012 where it's set. I know it was shot, you know, like a couple of years ago, but Garnett was on the downside of his career. He was, I think, 36 years old, as depicted in the movie. And they actually relate it to a real life, like, series of events. So, like,
of
they're
game,
playing,
yeah,
the playoffs against Philadelphia 76ers is like the second round. And they ended up winning that, of course, in game seven, where he wins his big bet. But they go on to lose to LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh in the Eastern Conference Finals. But this is like 4 or 5 years after the big three came together, Ray Allen, Paul Pierce, and Kevin Garnett, to win the championship in 2008. And so this is like the last kind of chance for them to try to win another one. And so that's why a lot of Sandler's bets were paying off, because people were writing Kevin Garnett off because he was older, slower, not as mobile. He had injuries. But because he had that relationship with Garnett, he had like one-on-one interactions with him. And he was like, hey, I know he's like super hyped about this like rare stone. I think he's going to go off tonight because he thinks it imbues power into him. And so that's why he was willing to make those bets. But also, the guy's a gambling addict. Like, he was betting money he owed to three different people. Like, that money was spoken for three times over. It's like he's running the fucking Fed, you know? Like, it was incredible the how he would take a bird in the hand and shit in the bush, you know, ridiculously. And like you were saying, Robert, earlier, he should have been probably killed multiple times over with how he was treating people who he owed large sums of money to. Like, this isn't a couple of $100. He owed $100,000 to Arno. He owed who knows how much to those guys he gave a fake watch to. He owed money to his father-in-law. He owed money to a bunch of people. And he owed them all simultaneously, and whatever money he had, they all had equal claim to it. And yet, he let it ride on some trifecta-like bet. Like, he had to get the opening tip. He had to get the points, the rebounds. They had to get the win. Like, 25 different things had to happen for him to win. That is insane.
Yeah, and if he loses it, he's probably a dead man. I mean, spoilers. He's a dead man anyway. But that was probably due to him imprisoning a couple of gangsters in his business while he watched the game. This is like the last insult that these hardcore killers with shark eyes, that guy had shark eyes. He was not messing around. He's not someone to mess around with. And he's like, look at this cool bet I did, guys. Aren't you excited? Now you're going to get paid. And he's just like, I do not give, all my fucks went out the door when you locked me in for 3 hours, dude.
Yeah, you know, when I was watching this, I was like, he's running a luxury gem business to high clientele. He's got a really nice house and an apartment in the city. It seems like he's got other sources or, you know, other, like, what's the right word? Like, he's got a certain amount of wealth. So I was like, why doesn't he just sell his house and pay off his bets? Or why doesn't he just do this and pay off his bets? Why is selling this thing for like $200,000? He was hoping to get $1 million. But why is that going to make or break him? Like, to me, he was living such an extravagant lifestyle that the amount of money he was staking to or trying to win didn't seem worth it.
Well, and it wouldn't be enough. For a guy like that, no matter what he wins, it's not going to be enough. He wins that $1.3 million or whatever it was, and then he goes on his vacation. He comes back. 2 weeks later, that money's gone.
Well, he owes half of it to...
He owes half of it to half the town, but then whatever money he does have is going right back into his gambling habit. So, and I know women are risk takers and they like risk takers, but I did not buy that relationship where she's like, oh man, I love you. Look at your betting, even though you got 50 guys trying to kill you right now. Oh, this is so exciting. And I'm going to go and try and hide from these gangsters as I'm placing this bet. Maybe there's a personality of a female out there that's into that kind of thing. But from my experience as a human being that's been on this planet for as many years as I have been, women are far more pragmatic. And yes, they're attracted to risk and the big rewards that come with that, but only so long as you're winning. If you lose, then, and they don't see you as a stable provider, then they're out. And I think that relationship was doomed to fail. I think it was going to last for as long as he was winning. And as soon as he was out. So all that whole I love you crap was, I just didn't buy it. Maybe she really did. Maybe there's something in the relationship that happened. Am I crapping out? Sorry, guys. I'm gonna have to speak in short sound bites like I'm on cable news or something. Sorry.
I thought it was believable that she would hang around him, his girlfriend on the side. And I don't know if it's that. So, okay, as an aside, my wife and I, it's not an aside, but my wife and I have been watching junk television on Hulu, and one of the shows is Unexpected, and it's basically MTV's Teen Mom. And I know I feel bad enough about watching this shit, but it's very junk television, mindless crap. But these 16-year-old kids, you know, that grow up in bad environments and generations of teen moms and serial impregnators, I could see them doing this shit, you know, just getting caught up way over their head. And this girlfriend, what was her position? Was she an escort? It wasn't clear.
Julia? No, she worked there. She sold, worked for him. Like, her photography, right? She was selling her photography skills to high
profile clients. An escort or something like that, or like a middleman, like a lead generator, like the other guy.
I didn't get that impression. I got the impression that she was a photographer, that she was trying to get high profile clients and make big money there, and that she was using her feminine wiles to kind of secure those contracts.
Yeah, wasn't she like she's working the counter, like she was the counter girl at the gem store?
Yeah, that was her day job, and then her night job was her photography career.
Yeah, and coke habit.
Well, you gotta have a good time.
Yeah, so in the pre-show content, we were you guys were talking, well, I got more wine, about The Weeknd, who makes an appearance in this film, and whether The Weeknd and Julia were doing anything that Sandler's character should have been upset about or not. So let's drag that from the bonus content into the main content here. My opinion, because I didn't hear what you guys said because I was out getting wine, was that The Weeknd was trying to put the moves on her when they were in the bathroom together doing the coke, and she was resisting-ish, it seemed. Like, maybe she was going to, like...
Yeah, doing that play resisting. Go ahead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you know, as what's his name? Ari? Adam Sandler's character? He doesn't know that. All he knows is his girlfriend is in this bathroom, locked in there with this famous guy doing drugs and being in there alone and whatever. I think that he was probably, you know, justifiably upset about this.
She also touched his dick.
Yeah, she did. Might have been over the pants, but still a dick touch.
Still. I mean, was she doing it really to... I don't know. I think it was justified in being upset. Maybe if he knew beforehand that she was doing it to secure a lead or something like that, maybe he shouldn't have been so upset if he had known about it and agreed to it. But, yeah. What do you think, Robert?
I mean, I think that oftentimes you get involved with people like that and you're kind of playing with fire, so that when you act all surprised, you kind of had it coming. Like, you know,
in terms of her relationship with Ari or her relationship with The Weeknd?
I think with what you're saying is Ari, right? Like,
I think Ari knew what kind of a person she was, and that there was a certain amount of what attracted him to her is what's attracted lots of men to her, and that she's going to be that person, and she's going to be flirtatious, and she's going to get in compromising situations probably. And to expect her to not do that is kind of a double standard. Like, oh, I met you in a club and man, we got physical like right away, and we did coke together. And then like 3 weeks later, I catch you doing coke with some guy. Oh my God. I'm so outraged. I mean, I'm kind of, you know, reading into the situation a little bit. I don't know exactly how they met. I don't know how she got hired on at the place. But she struck me as this was a normal activity for her and for him to get outraged by finding. I mean, clearly, I mean, he found the two alone in a bathroom and they were just getting kind of semi-sexual, which might have led to full-on sexual. But this is kind of her jam. This is kind of what she does. And for him to get a little bit outraged about it is a little bit disingenuous, I think.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that, Robert. It seemed to me similar to some relationships I've had in the past where it's either really good or really bad, like a roller coaster. And I think that she was like that. So like they were either like madly in love with each other and like so into each other and everything was great, or it was a total disaster. And it kept fluctuating between those two things. And then, of course, he had this whole situation with his family, with his estranged wife, where due to religious reasons, they were still maintaining the semblance of being together for extended family and for the kids. And they were like trying to plan when they were going to, you know, make the announcement that they were divorcing or separating. So there were a lot of things kind of at play here and, you know, it also plays in, I think, to Ari, like being... has that gambling spirit in all aspects. Like he's taking risks everywhere all the time, even in relationships. So not only in the gambling and in the business and in the shafting of people he owes money and betting the money he owes to people he doesn't even have a claim on, which I have a great Rothbard clip where he's talking about money and banking and how if the banker has like this great tip on a race and he takes the money out, you've entrusted the money, you've put the money into the bank and it's supposed to be safe and whatever. And he takes that money out. He's got a great tip on a race, and he goes out and he wins a bunch of money. Well, he's still stolen the money, even though he didn't lose it, because he took it from your position and put it at undue risk. So I'll post that on the show notes page because it's really good. I'm not sure how I got to this point, but I had a note to mention that at some point. So that's why I did that. This is such a great show.
Excellent.
Of course. It makes sense. Raising it in, I love it.
Well, he says crookery is objective. Basically, if you take it and bet it, you've stolen the money. What happens after that is immaterial to the act of the theft.
Oh, yeah. Adam Sandler is acting disingenuously in thievery the whole movie. This is his character, and this is why I was said he should have been dead long before the movie started. If this is how he acts all the time, and there's nothing for us to go on to assume that he doesn't. This whole movie is hectic. He is high drama the whole time, and he's robbing Peter to pay Paul. He's floating money he doesn't have. He's pissing off all kinds of dangerous people, and he's acting like it's almost no big deal. Like he's got killers in the room with him, and he's acting like, oh, come on, this is whatever. I'm gonna get your money or whatever. I think he was playing with forces he didn't understand, and he should have known better. I mean, he's playing with killers, and sooner or later he's gonna get burned. You play stupid games, you win stupid prizes. That's what I've heard said many times, and I think it's true.
Sounds like what's going on right now with the rioting and people getting killed around the rioting.
Yep.
Yeah. So, Pat, you wanted to talk about this movie, and in your description of it to me via IMs, you were just like, things happen and just keeps happening, keeps happening, keeps happening. It's just like cascading on top of each other. So what was the thing that made you want to discuss this one that was related to that?
I mean, I think this movie is a fucking masterpiece, and maybe I'm one to really kind of jump on that train, but the way this movie makes you feel is incredibly anxious and just complete anxiety, because the way it's shot, people are talking over each other. There's no expositional dialogue, which is something I wanted to talk about based on what Robert just said. But the camera angles are very claustrophobic. I was watching something on YouTube, a review about this movie, and it was talking about how usually you have your actors, you have like X's on the ground for cinematography purposes, so you know exactly how to get the angle right. But this was shot with, like, I don't know if it was a telescopic lens, but they gave the actors a lot of room to interact with each other. And the dialogue is written in a way that I love the dialogue writing. It's very realistic, and people are talking over each other. One thing just happens after another, and I know this because I've watched this film with my wife and my son, and my son is 14 months old, and he's running around screaming and getting into stuff and just being a 14-year-old or a 14-month-old boy, and this movie's playing at the same time, and my wife and I are just getting more and more worked up and like, holy shit, I can't handle this right now. Like, we got to turn this shit off. We just got to turn this shit off.
And I'm so glad. I'm so glad you brought that up, Pat, because I had the same experience. Like you said, the no exposition. I noticed that also. There's zero explaining dialogue going on in this movie. You are just in this world, and it's happening, and you got to figure out what it is, what they're talking about through context, which I loved. It was just like you're being set in this world, and nobody's spending the time to explain it.
I hate expositional dialogue too, and like. So I was a creative writing major in undergrad, and so I hate movies that do that. And I like that it leaves it up to us to figure out what the relationships are between these characters. And this is a great example of it. You were just trying to explain his relationship with his girlfriend and his wife and this guy who brings leads in, and we have no fucking idea but I think our interpretations of it is really what gives meaning to the piece. And the fact that there's a little ambiguity into it, it just makes it a deeper work of art, I think.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that for sure. And now, and in terms of the tension, I stopped this movie, I think, 3 or 4 times. Simply because I was like, holy crap, I got to stop this and reset and rest. Because I am so amped up. There's the tension, especially when he's got that bet on the line and he's got the mobsters in the booth. And he's watching the game. I stopped that scene like 2 or 3 times. This movie is great with tension. It's almost too much for me as like some old man or something. I don't know, but it was very masterfully done.
Yeah, you're usually the one who's saying there's not enough tension in a scene, or that you really appreciate there being a sufficient amount of tension.
There needs to be some.
Yeah.
But this movie cranks it up. It's great.
But it was everything, though. I mean, it was so that, like, the camera angles, the lens they used, it was the grain of the footage and the frame rate of the footage. And it was the dialogue and the way that all of the actors were placed in the set too, and the delivery. And holy shit, Kevin Garnett did an awesome job. I mean, I thought his performance was incredible. And I thought we'd touch on this too, but Adam Sandler, this is the performance of his career, I think. I mean, I really do. I've enjoyed a lot of his work before. And to be fair, I guess I haven't seen Spanglish or Love Actually. But I don't know how it could possibly top this. I mean, he created a character that was at the same time that you disliked him and that he was kind of grimy. I rooted for him. And Robert, I know you pushed back on this because earlier in the episode you were saying you didn't like him. But I was rooting for him. And even though I thought he was a bad person, I thought there were elements of him that were an uncut gem. He's a gem.
Boo this man.
So I, you know, and that's what he is. He's an uncut gem, and he has qualities in him that are very good. I think he's a good father, or he wants to be, but he's not a good father.
He's got a good wanting heart. To be a good father and being a good father are two wildly different things.
That's true, but he tries, even though it's an afterthought, you know.
Yeah, I think you have something to this. He has a good heart, but he doesn't have execution.
He's a degenerate gambler that is an asshole to everybody he deals with. He is going to burn so many bridges. If he survives the movie and goes on and make a sequel or whatever, who's he going to get money from? Who's he going to? Nobody. Nobody would want to do business with this guy. I wouldn't.
Yeah.
Who would want to be in a relationship with him? Nobody, I would hope.
We must be seeing rock bottom. I mean, we have to be seeing that.
Well, he's put himself in this position where he's willing to die if the bet doesn't pay off. Like, this is the culmination of a long-term, like, growth of his, like, being a speculator, making long-shot bets, hoping that they'll pay off.
Well, he's living in fantasy land, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And he's actually taken a very long view of this, getting this opal from these West African,
very unlike
African
him.
Jews in Ethiopia from a mine who stole it with this, you know, this cover of this guy having this compound fracture, which not a good way to open a film. You go right out of Anderson's butt, and then you see this compound fracture at the Ethiopian mine. It's like, that's, just the hits keep coming. But there's also the appraisal. Like, he had banked on this opal being worth over $1 million and going to this auction. He spent 2 years trying to get this. And then to get it appraised for, what was it, $125,000? When he finally got it into the auctioneer's hands, because he foolishly let Garnett take it with him to the playoff game in exchange for his Celtic ring.
Yeah, that I had a little bit of a problem with that scene where it was like an obvious mistake he was making, and it seemed like to be artificially creating tension. Like, obvious plot point is obvious kind of situation where it's like, here, I'm going to do this dumb thing and it's not going to work out. Now you're going to bring it back, right? You're going to bring it back. You promise, like, super promise, even though I'll take your Celtic, you know, championship ring as collateral, but it still felt like, why would he do that? I mean, it made sense a little bit. He's like, okay, you got to put it on Instagram. You're going to get some bling shots. You're going to mention my name, that kind of thing. We're going to increase my brand. So in that sense, if this is something that happens a lot, but he had so much writing on this stupid opal, right? I mean, of course he's going to screw it up, and even if he hits, the money's going to be gone. But it seemed like even for a crazed gambler to be a risky move.
Yeah, but it was Kevin Garnett, you know, like, is Kevin Garnett going to fuck you over?
Probably not, but he's going to be a little bit flaky. right? And you need that stone back by a certain date to be in this auction, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and it was flaky because, what was the guy's name, Deontay, who was the handler dude? He kept saying, oh yeah, I'll meet you here at this time. And he's like hours and hours late. And then if he does show up, he doesn't have the thing when he says he had it. So like, to me, if I have that much riding on something and the guy's like chronically late, and then when he finally does show up, it turns out he's been lying to you the whole time. That's going to sever the relationship for me.
I mean, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, and that's the other thing, like, the conflicts he would have even with people who were his friends. Like, he was saying things and they were saying the things to him that me personally would be like, I'm never talking to that person again. But it seemed like no big deal. You know, like right. The next scene, they're talking again.
Yeah, like he beat the shit out of me and then, oh, we're still friends. Or I hate you, you're an asshole. And the next time you see him, oh, hey, buddy, what's up? I don't know if that's a New York thing. That's a big city thing. But you're right. For me, that was like, that crosses so many friendship lines that I don't even know what kind of relationship.
Yeah, like so many times I'd be like, all right, well, I'm done with that person, you know, and then next scene, oh, okay, everything's okay. It's like the Adam Sandler character in this, it's a serious movie, but he's not he's acting seriously in serious situations, but he's not treating them seriously. It's kind of this weird thing.
He is a child. He seems to be a child living in fantasy land where the consequences of his actions never gonna materialize. He thinks he seems like he's gonna be able to endlessly float and play this adrenaline high forever, and it's never gonna come home to roost. And that's why I was rooting for him to die. I was rooting for him to have consequences. I'm the exact opposite of Pat in this movie. He was rooting for Adam to succeed and do well and hit this big win, and I'm rooting for him to face the consequences of his actions.
I, against my best interest, I was rooting for him. I think like it was a bit more complicated than that. Like, yeah, I wanted him to win despite myself because he was such a greasy kind of grimy character, and yeah. So I was going to go on this whole thing about how I was watching this film in preparation for us to talk about it, and I couldn't find any sort of like libertarian ANCAP angles to go at. And I think we identified some, like in terms of like exploitation and the Ethiopians, like why did he get this Ethiopian or the gem market or something like that, I guess. But I kept thinking of this thing like in undergrad. Of course, I went to the University of Minnesota and the whole department was a bunch of Marxists. And so all they would do, seriously, my whole degree was all about class conflict. And that was the only fucking lens they could see anything through. And so I was like, well, how does this relate to the ANCAP movement, or at least like to your show? Because what you do is you view things through an ANCAP lens. Well, what do we do with this show when there's so much more here aside from just an ANCAP NAP analysis? You know what I mean? But because there's so much.
Yeah, well, I think Robert's made a point a couple of shows ago where we're less a libertarian ANCAP show per se. I mean, we still pepper it in here and there, but we're more of just a movie review show at this point. I think there's some validity to that argument, though I think we do, or at least I try to shoehorn some stuff in.
Yeah.
But you did mention that the Ethiopians and the exploitation, and Kevin Garnett actually brings up this point in the film. Yep. He's like, wait, wait, wait. So how much did you pay these guys in Ethiopia for this? And you're trying to sell it for $1 million? And Sandler's point is, hey, I'm paying them 50 lifetimes worth of what they would earn, you know, in an entire lifetime. So, you know, relatively speaking, they're doing very, very well. And, you know, Cagey's kind of arguing that he's doing it for almost racist reasons. But Garnett also misunderstands the structure of production, because this is the raw good coming out of the earth is going to be one price versus bringing it all the way through the supply chain to a place where it's actually saleable, right? There's a time frame that's involved. There's connections. There's, you know, these guys found it in the earth. It's not like they found it ready for auction with the right connections to be able to auction it. There's a whole series of events and things that need to happen for it to go from one place to another. And so for Garnett to misunderstand that and say, well, right out of the ground, it's worth $1 million is not true. You know, for it to be in the position to be sold, for a consumer to be able to buy it, that infrastructure means to market, to bring that good into position, into a state to be purchased, is another string of the value that gets imbued into the product. And of course, it's all subjective value. It's whoever's willing to pay a certain amount for it. And that appraisal, the underpricing of the appraisal, almost poisons the well for the auction, right? Because his original appraisal was going to go into that catalog and say, oh yeah, it's valued between $800,000 and $1.2 million. And so the bid would start at a certain amount and probably get over $1 million. But when they came back and said, oh, you know, the appraisal is 100 to 150. Well, of course, he's going to be upset by that. Now, I don't know what the true value or the true appraisal of something like that would be. But Pat, I'll direct this question to you. Do you think that Sandler would have had a case in that the appraisal being so low compared to what he thinks a fair market appraisal would be like, and there wasn't time to go to a third party to really get like an objective appraisal, which of course solves the Ayn Rand problem of competing defense agencies blank out. You know, you'd have a third one adjudicate that they would all agree to beforehand. But what's your take on that? Like, do you think that they were doing him not quite a harm, but like impacting his potential for value or potential for sale? And this gets really muddy, you know, because like you're not owed what you could make or whatever. But do you think that there was an effect with their lowballing the appraisal?
I think that's a really complicated question, because at the same time, what is your market in terms of what the auction is? It didn't seem to me like this was a open market auction. It was a closed market auction. And at the same time that Adam Sandler, that Ari, he needs to sell the gem. At any point in time, I think he could have withdrawn his gem from the auction. And so I don't think it's an NAP violation per se, or, you know, any violation of property rights, because he could have withdrawn it at any point in time. But the problem is, and this is the whole point of the movie, is that his time preference is so high, he needs to sell it.
Yeah, well, he's got so much money owed to so many people.
Right.
That he almost, whether he wants to or not, he has to do it all quickly.
Yeah. But from the auctioneer's point of view, they don't give a fuck. Why should they? You know, you don't like it, go somewhere else. Did that answer your question? Go ahead, Robert.
I was just gonna make the question. I mean, I understand the get the money quickly, and he needed this auction to happen. But if he was so upset that he had to have a certain amount, why not set a minimum reserve price? Like, this is the minimum amount I'll take for this opal. I won't take anything less than 175.
Because that would break the plot.
Well, yeah. There's that. Wow.
Fair enough.
Yeah, one final comment on KG's point, like, well, you're kind of ripping off these Ethiopian dudes. The Ethiopian dudes stole this opal from the mine that they don't own. So do you think that they can fully expect to fence a stolen item for the full retail value?
I would hope not. No, they're lucky to get whatever he's offering. And obviously he's offering the highest price that they can get.
Yeah, and they're totally agreeable to it, you know. And like you said, it's 50 times their lifetime wages. Plus, you know, what he thought he was only offering them 10% of the final retail price, it ended up being over half.
Yeah, and I really liked his argument against KG when he was saying, hey, do you want to win by one, or do you want to win by 30? This is what I do. I'm adding value to this product by talking about it, by showing it to you, by showing it to other people, whatever his means is. And he wants to get the maximum value out of his product. Who doesn't? Who doesn't want to sell it for the most? Is he evil for wanting to get the most out of his property? That's just...
Yeah. Well, and moreover, he's taking the risk. You know, what if it's nothing? He's never seen it before. He's seen it on a documentary television program.
Right. Yeah. He had to
smuggle it in a bunch of fish.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's not only doing that risk, like he's putting a certain amount of money in, and he's not sure what he's going to get out of it or what the item's actually going to be when it arrives.
Or if it gets caught by an
illegal shit.
Yeah, it could customs could have seized it.
Right. Yeah. So there were like several times of risk. I mean, this is another example of his gambling, and like you were saying, you know, he has that competitive nature to him, similar to KG. That's how he's able to identify with him. It's almost a whatever means necessary approach, which ends up being his downfall, because despite like actually winning a couple of things like that would have gone in his favor, but other people kind of took them away from him, like that one bet that he made with the maitre d' at the restaurant, where it was like the first playoff game against the Sixers, and Arno, his brother-in-law,
Arno
takes the
it,
bet. Yeah, he blocks the bet, and he would have paid off big, like a couple hundred grand or whatever. It would have paid off Arno, would have paid off like all this other stuff. He probably would have been broken even, but of course he's an addict, so he wouldn't have stopped. You know, he just continued on. But he had that, and then also the gem itself not work out for him due to things outside of his control, right? So Arno stopped that bet. That was out of his control. The appraiser kind of stopped the auction going up as high. So that was another like a win that he should have had, right? Because had the original appraisal gone through, it probably would have auctioned for a lot more than it did. And then he finally does strike big on this like 28-way parlay with his girlfriend taking the money that KG gives him for the gem that he should have paid off Arno, should have paid off his father-in-law, should have paid off the guy that he gave the fake watch to. Like, he should have made as much of those folks whole as he could have. Well, actually, it's only 175, and he owed all of that to his father-in-law, and he owed 100 to Arno. So I guess he was kind of fucked either way.
Well, he was still getting the money from the auctioneers.
Right, but that was all going to go... Oh, wait, no, he wasn't getting any money from them.
Yeah, he was.
Well, from his father-in-law, though.
Right. The father pays the auctioneers, they take their cut, and then he gets a big chunk of that. And then he can pay that back to his father-in-law. So he probably owed his father-in-law like 30 grand or something.
Right, and then he still owed Arno 100 grand.
Right.
And he still owed the other guy however much.
Right.
And all of that. But this whatever means necessary aspect or approach and the super high time preference that he had, these are all things of his own making and due to the addictive nature or the addiction that he had to gambling and taking big risks. But when he finally did have it pay off, it was all for naught because he had made so many enemies along the way, people angry enough to kill him. And so it kind of ends in a way, and we can start winding down the show here, I think, but it ends in a way where he has that one fleeting moment of it all coming together. He wins the big bet. His girlfriend
he dies
says
happy.
She loves him. Yeah. And before he can even realize he's going to get shot in the head, he dies with a smile on his face.
Yeah.
So he had that one nirvanic
probably
moment.
The best way he could have ever gone out. Otherwise, he ends homeless and destitute and dying of some curable disease in an alley. I mean, it doesn't end happy, the other timeline. This way, he goes out on top.
So this is the ending point too, where it all comes home, I think, is because what does an uncut gem mean? What do you guys make of, and I know it's cliche because it's the title of the film, but what do you guys make of the fact that KG sees this gem and he looks in it and he sees his whole path to becoming an NBA star? And when Ari looks into the gem, he sees whatever he makes of it. I can't remember if that's the case, but is, and this kind of plays into too, because I was looking at other analysis of the film, and that Ari's character basically is an uncut gem in of itself, because he has admirable qualities, but they are unrefined. And I think that's the overall theme of the film. What do you guys make of that?
Well, and then looking into the gem and seeing like the intricacies of all these things that are billions of years old, like, doesn't he make mention of like this gem was created when the universe was created, and that's what, like, how it came to be, and it like landed on Earth and then it got compacted into this aggregate or whatever. I mean, I don't know, you can probably read a bunch of analogies into this, and that's one of the things, like we were talking about earlier, there's a certain artistic quality to this film, to where it is without narrative and it is somewhat ambiguous, and so you can read into it so many different things and different perspectives. So I don't know if I mean, Garnett seemed to look at this as a way to rejuvenate himself or psych himself up, Like he felt that this had mystical powers to him because he was near the ending of his career. So he was looking for whatever would amp him up enough to be able to play a couple of good more games. I mean, I don't know how much longer he played after this. I don't think it was that long. And granted, they shot this film probably just a couple of years ago. So he still looks like he's, you know, playing weight, looked like. Man's in good shape still.
Yeah, man. Looks good. You still beat me. I don't know about the mystical whatevers, but I do know that I didn't see Adam Sandler as an uncut gem. I refuse to say that he's got all these wonderful qualities. This movie was a train wreck. Like, his life was a train wreck. The movie's great, but this was a horrifying, watching a descent into destruction, self-destruction. This is an addict hitting rock bottom. This is the same as like a train spotting movie or, you know, any kind of addict where he is destroying all his relationships. He's ruining his own life all to satisfy his addiction. And it's fascinating and it's compelling, but I wasn't rooting for this guy. I didn't think he was a good guy. I think he was somebody who had succumbed to his addiction. He had given up on living any kind of a rational life. He was chasing the dragon 24/7. And the people in his life that cared about him, be damned. He was willing to sacrifice everything. Not necessarily like he was going to sell his kids to whatever, like a pedophile or something. But he didn't give a damn that he was pissing off people with shark eyes. I mean, it seemed like a very, I hate to say the word selfish, but I mean, because, you know, you own your own body, you own your own life, and you live it however you want. But it seemed to be like he was a father and his children relied on him for sustenance, for love, for stewardship, for fathership, you know, all the reasons you would need a dad. And he was on a train to death, or an early grave. And to be chasing that dragon is the same as like just doing heroin and then he's like a useless dad, deadbeat on the street. I think he's an example of what not to do, how not to be a parent, how not to be a father, how not to be a human being. This is a tragic story of a man succumbing to his addiction. Fascinating, compelling. But this movie was like watching a train wreck.
I mean, did you see any qualities to him, though? I mean, even though they were not likable, but did you see any qualities to him that could be considered admirable in terms of talent or the ability to hustle or anything like that, or the person ability to interact with KG or high profile clients? Because when I think of the term uncut gem, I don't think of maybe a moral superiority or morality or anything, but he had these qualities, you know. I guess that's what I'm getting at, is when I say that I root for him, it's like, you know, I'd like things to turn out for him and for his family to be okay and all that kind of stuff. But also that he has these innate abilities, even though I think he's a despicable person. It's more complicated than saying he's a good guy or he's a bad guy. And that's what I think makes good film or art.
Yeah, no, there's definitely some nuance there. Let me ask you this question, though, Pat. When he was talking to his wife, he's at that Jewish event with his family and whatever, and he's talking to his wife, and he's like, give me another chance. Give me another shot. Before she talks, before she answers, what did you want her to say?
No.
So you were rooting against him, too. I definitely wanted her to laugh in his face and say, are you kidding?
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. But I mean, I guess that's because I know that he was going to milk her for everything. I mean, even though I wanted everything to come together to him, I guess I didn't view it in the same way that you did in terms of, well, okay, what happens if he wins, right? Are his kids going to be okay? Is his marriage going to be okay? Is his wife going to be taken care of?
Yeah, definitely not. No.
He's going to bet it all again.
Yeah, he's going to roll it. He's going to keep it going, man.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. So what is the uncut gem part of him? I mean, you know, like, okay, what is the true meaning of a work of art? Is it what the artist intends it to be, or is it what we perceive it to be?
It can only be what you perceive it to be. I think everybody's going to have their own opinion on it, including the artist himself or herself.
Yeah. But what do you think, and maybe Daniel, what do you think the artist's intent is here with this uncut gem thing? What's the admirable qualities?
Well, I think what they're trying to say is that Sandler's character has a good heart, but he's let his addictions kind of take over. And so while he means well, he can't help himself. And so he doesn't want to go out of his way to hurt people, but he is only thinking of himself for that big score, that big win. Everything else be damned. And it is kind of amazing when this cascading series of events happen. He's handling them rather deftly for the precariousness in which they are. I mean, he's managing like all these ideas and these deadlines and all these things in his head. Like, there's one scene where he's answering the phone call and he's trying to call the lawyer to threaten KG's like counsel or whatever. And then like someone else is calling to chew him out, and he's like doing all this stuff, and it's just rapid fire. And he's like shifting gears so quickly. Like, he has these innate skills and abilities that if he would just apply them to something of value, he could have been tremendous. But he was so consumed by this addiction to gambling and to just putting it all on the line and all risking everything, despite having a good heart. And perhaps that's the uncut gem portion. Like, he has some good qualities where he means well, but it's so not refined that he's actually causing all this harm.
Yeah, this character reminds me of George in Of Mice and Men. He's just the simple guy. He just wants to pet the bunnies, but he doesn't know the harm he's causing. And Lenny has to put him down. And this is the movie is him getting put down. Adam Sandler's character getting put down. He doesn't know the harm he's causing. He's a good-hearted man who's smart, but he doesn't understand what damage he's doing to the people around him. And he pays for it.
I think that in like a Jordan Peterson way, it's like this gem represents the chaos of potential in a certain way. It's very interesting.
Yeah, and had he honed it down and refined it, perhaps he would have been a more complete person, a more effective person, providing more value and being more successful. Though, I mean, he seemed to be in a position where he had excess with which to risk throwing away.
I wonder how that relates to KG. You know, what does KG, when he looks into the gem and he sees everything that brought him to the point of being an NBA star, is he seeing the true potential of the gem? You know, has he refined the chaos of potential in his own, and he's rediscovering it now? I don't know, I guess.
I think he saw the end of his career and he was like looking for something to spark him for, you know, one final run at the championship.
To re-see the chaos of the potential in his earlier career, maybe? I don't know.
Well, yeah, it does. I don't know about this reseeding and chaos and potential and stuff, and I can't speak to that. But it is interesting. It does kind of raise an interesting issue of sports psychology and how a lot of super high-end athletes get into this kind of power of positive thinking and just a belief in something. And it goes beyond, because there's so much. I mean, you're at the highest level. You need an edge, and you're looking for that edge. And it's so much of performance is psychological. You could be all prepared, like physically, but if you don't prepare emotionally and mentally for the actual event happening. Now, at this point in his career, Garnett's a veteran, and he's been on this stage many, many times, and he's looking for that edge. But in terms of general sports performance, the psychological aspect is very vastly underanalyzed, I would say, and the level of sports psychology necessary for high-end performing athletes is... Am I just going to repeat myself again?
Well, there's a lot of mind over matter that happens. Like, if you think you can't do something, then you can't. And if you think that you can, like, I've run a couple of marathons, and not enough to, like, really know what I'm talking about too much here, but... Like, if you give up in your mind, then your body will break down. But if you fight through it and you're mentally like, I'm going to do this, somehow you find a way. And I think that that's sort of what Garnett was looking for. He was looking for something to spark his mental to bring his body along, because his body was older and been through injuries and all these things.
Yeah, for sure. No, like in fighting, like I like UFC a lot. And, you know, you go through like a 5-round war, and it's the guy that mentally quits is the guy that's going to lose a lot of the time, because it's everybody's bodies are just broken down. And it's the guy that whose eye is dull and just like, no, I'm done.
If it's, well, shit, I just learned two new things about you guys, even though I've known you for like 4 years now. So I didn't know that, Daniel, I didn't know you ran marathons. And Robert, I didn't know you were into UFC, because I'm into running and I'm into UFC.
What? So did we just become best friends?
Yep.
I mean, how much Jordan Peterson have you watched, Robert? I mean, this is all he talks about is the chaos of potential.
Oh, shit. Well, I guess not enough. I have seen a few things, a few talks that he's done, but no, I guess I don't. This is new to me.
I've been, you know, I'm struggling with life transitions right now, if y'all want to know everything about myself, even a colonoscopy. So here we go. But, you know, this is so akin to what it's like being a lawyer, too. I mean, a lot of it's a mental game. You know, you're enough. There's a lot of grind to it at the same time. But I'm reading books right now about how to perform as a lawyer. And it's all about these mental games that you play with yourself and how you view yourself. And a lot. Jordan Peterson has had a lot to do with my own journey, too, trying to figure out, you know, what the hell I'm doing. And there's the chaos of potential. I don't know. There's not much else to say about it, I guess.
Well, we should probably say much more about this stuff in the bonus content that we have available for our Patreon supporters at lastnighters.com/Patreon, because we're already past the normal length of the show, unfortunately. So I have a few more notes related to the film. I think I'll maybe mention them in the bonus content. But before we get into that, we got to end with final summary and review. So we'll go to Robert. Unless anyone has any final notes they want to sneak in there, just slip it in there.
Yeah, one quick thing. What is this performance in terms of, we touched on this, but in terms of Adam Sandler's career, performance of his career, what do you think?
Quickly. Best ever. I thought he was great in Punch Drunk Love. I thought he's a great like leading romantic lead in 50 First Dates and that sort of thing, and Wedding Singer, that kind of thing. He's very charming, very funny, very affable. I could see how people would like him, how women would, you know, like him, despite he's not the best looking guy ever. But in this film, I mean, that's why I didn't buy the romance, because he's just plays this train wreck of a guy in this movie. But fantastic performance. I mean, the best of his career, for sure, that I've seen.
Okay. I'm going to say I prefer him in Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore, because that's the height of his powers, his comedic powers. But this is the height of his acting. This is his best acting performance. Not his most entertaining, not his most fun, not a movie I'm going to go back and watch again and again, like I have seen Happy Gilmore and Billy Madison a dozen times each.
I want him to do more stuff like this. I think his recent comedy movies are garbage. They're not funny at all. But this stuff I can fully get on board with, and I would watch another film of this quality level from him, for sure.
Oh, right. Yeah, he has done a couple of movies. Like, there's one where he's like a CIA agent or something, and another one who's like in a Western comedy kind of thing, maybe on Netflix. It's all vague because I didn't watch them. But I'm sure they were terrible.
Yeah, they're all super panned, unfunny, toilet humor. I don't know. It's more like he has a bunch of money. He gets a bunch of money from Netflix, and he makes a bunch of movies, crappy movies with his friends, and they all have a great time making them, and they don't care about the quality. And that's fine for him. Great for him. Not so great if you're, you know, a fan that you want to see him do good stuff. But he doesn't know. He doesn't owe me anything. He can do what he wants. He's a grown-ass man. And when he does stuff like this, I will applaud him. And then when he does scatological cowboy western, I'll be like, it's not for me. That's maybe for some 12-year-old somewhere.
All right, well, that's a good jumping off point into final summary and review. So, Robert, if you want to take it from there.
Well, initially, I was just right off the bat really impressed with the intro and how it's, I mean, it seemed like the director had really been watching a lot of Stranger Things. It very much struck me as this kind of 80s kind of really set some kind of a weird mood. I wasn't sure what I was getting into. Like, what is this? What am I going to be watching? Is this some sort of psychedelic 60s or 70s? But then it kind of had this 80s, like, neon techno vibe. And then it was this thriller, dramedy, serious thing about this jeweler. So what? Well, I don't know what it is, but I know I like it. It's got excellent performances. It's a living, breathing world. As much as I don't think it's a very realistic character, it's definitely a very exciting and compelling character. Like I said, I think it's unrealistic for him to have lived this long. He would have died years and years ago if this is his character. Now, maybe this, like Pat's saying, this is his rock bottom and he's on this like sharp decline and he's just now reaching the peak of his depravity. I guess that's what we're led to believe. But excellent film. I would give this like an 8.5. I kind of tend to agree with Danielle that I wouldn't necessarily come back to it a whole lot. Maybe I'll watch it again in a few years or maybe 5 or 10 years and kind of like enjoy it again. But it is a very much a high tension film. And you got to be in the right kind of frame of mind to enjoy that. I was kind of watching it and enjoying it, but then it got to be too much for me and I would shut it off and then start it up again. So maybe it's best, you know, enjoyed in chunks of time. I really don't know. Whatever you want to do. But I do recommend this film. This is a lot of fun. I'm glad Pat recommended it. I enjoyed this conversation. I'm just going to say it's an 8.5 from me. Highly recommended. Experience at least once. Even if you don't like Adam Sandler's other work, this is a serious piece that puts him along, you know, like the highly competent Hollywood actors. He's at the top of his acting powers and he plays a compelling character. Even if it's not a likable character, it's still something that I didn't want to, you know, I wanted to see how it all ended up. So good stuff.
All right. Very good. Yeah. I think that Jim Carrey had a similar arc where he had like really ridiculous stuff early in his career, where he was just a slapstick rubber faced comedic guy. And then he came back and did Eternal Sunshine and a couple of other like darker, more acting chops worthy films. But I don't know where he's at now. I know he's in Sonic the Hedgehog, which I haven't seen. And is he Sonic in that one?
He's Dr. Robotnik.
Dr. Robotnik.
He's the villain.
I don't even know who that
He's a rubbery, oh, okay, evil villain guy.
All right, so he's bringing it back.
I've only seen the trailers, but it seems like the perfect role for him. Or at least maybe the perfect role for him 20 years ago.
Well, when I saw him in Kick-Ass 2, I hated him.
I don't remember what he was in Kick-Ass 2.
He was like Colonel Karate Chop or something. Like, he's only in it for maybe half the movie because he dies in it. But he's like this strong,
I would have to chin, re-watch it,
like
you didn't
crew
like it?
Cut military guy, over the top.
Well, he loves to play over the top. But anyway, go ahead, Daniel. Yeah. Whoever's turn it is, go.
All right. Well, I'll since you mentioned my name, I'll say that this is a movie that I enjoy, but it is there's a lot of frantic, kinetic stuff going on. It's just tension after tension, and so you might need a break. And it also might not be something that you want to watch again, but I think it is a worthy experience. It is probably one of Sandler's strongest acting performances. In a way, I did kind of root for him because it does seem like he has a good heart, but he's just making mistake after mistake after mistake. And after a while, you're just amazed that he's still alive and that things haven't happened to him earlier, prior to this. But overall, it's a good experience. It's well done. The dialogue is great. The guerrilla style camera work is good. That really kind of adds to the tension and the chaotic nature of it. I don't think I liked it as much as Robert or Pat did, but I'll go with a 7.5 on this. I think it's well worth watching, and it's worth the price of a Netflix subscription to have it included. So let's go over to you, Pat, for your score, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, so I guess it's no surprise that I really enjoyed this film. I think it's a masterpiece, and I don't think I don't know, maybe I'm just a fanboy and I like to hand those out ad nauseum, but this really was, and I really want to profess my love for A24 and that production company. They've had a lot of incredible films, mostly horror films that I've really enjoyed because that's really my thing. But they've also had a lot of really deep films that really make you think. And I'm such an eclectic fan of film that those movies that really make you think that aren't necessarily the easiest to watch are the ones that I like the most. And I think the conversations that we've had in this episode are a testament to basically how deep this film is and how many different ways that you could analyze it in terms of sheer how uncomfortable this film made me physically. Really uncomfortable. And I think, again, that's a tribute to exactly an example of exactly how this film achieves what I think it sets out to do, is make a deep, claustrophobic, gritty film that is, it's just really great on a lot of different levels. So I hope you all enjoyed this episode. I really hope that you find a lot of the same things in the film that I did, but at least, you know, even if it isn't maybe a 10 out of 10 in terms of enjoyability, I don't know that works of art always should be enjoyable. But I think it is. I think I'd give it maybe a 9.5 or a 9. What do you guys think?
Well, that's high praise, high praise. And I think that you've said a lot of the episodes that you've been on with us talking about movies that they were masterpieces as well. So maybe you're an easy grader. I don't know. Have I really?
I probably didn't say that about Liar Liar. I think I said that about The Shining.
What American else? Psycho.
American Psycho. No, but I
My Cousin Vinny.
Not a masterpiece.
Star Trek The Next Generation.
Masterpiece.
Rogue One.
Rogue One, not a masterpiece.
Wild Wild Country.
Not a masterpiece.
Right, so we're just going through the list of prior appearances.
I said The Shining. The Shining was a masterpiece. That's it. I don't think you can knock me on that one.
No, Robert hated that one though.
It's true. I still hate it. But I can appreciate your enjoyment of the film.
Dr. Sleep.
Dr. Sleep was fun. Dr. Sleep was great.
The fuck?
That, you yeah, man.
No, you make no sense.
Dr. Sleep was totally a different movie.
Okay, who the fuck are you showing next week for your little show that you got here? What are you doing?
Oh, boy. All right.
Sorry.
Well, thanks for bringing that up. This is a good segue. So next week, we're going to bring back our guest from Les Miserables, just because Robert loves musicals so hard. We did Les Miserables with a buddy of ours named Alex Hay, and he suggested over a year ago that I should check out this movie, Alita Battle Angel. And I finally watched it this past weekend, and it was good. There's a lot of stuff worth talking about in it. I was like, all right, I finally watched this movie, and you willing to come on? And he said yes. So that is 90% sure that he's going to come on for Alita Battle Angel next week. Have you seen this, Robert?
Yeah, I saw it, geez, I don't know, maybe a year ago, maybe 2 years ago.
But is it a masterpiece?
No.
Well, tune in next week and you'll find out.
Spoilers, no. It's not bad. It's not bad, but I would definitely not put it in the masterpiece category.
Yeah, well, it is on the old HBO Max, so we both have access to it. And so we'll be doing that next week, audience. So you guys can support us by going to lastnighters.com/Patreon. You can see how the sausage is made. There's some other bonus content that we're going to be offering, like perhaps watching a movie with us. I think I can have up to 8 different guests watching it simultaneously. I'm not sure exactly how we interact with each other, but perhaps that's something we can all learn together. Robert, are there some other things that people can do to support what we do here?
Oh, yeah, there's always ways to do that, Daniel. You can write a letter, and you can send it to us. You can be like, Robert, you're awesome. You're just the best. You make me happy. And then that'll make me feel good. And then I'll be like, man, this is why I do this show. Just, you know, making people feel happy. And then also you could do the Patreon. You could go to trupster.com and buy some merchandise. You could subscribe to us on the YouTubes. You could subscribe on whatever platform you're currently listening, which you probably already do. You can join our Facebook groups. You know, you can just interact with us. You can talk to us and tell us why we're wrong. Tell us why we're right. Tell us why we make you so, so happy all the time. Probably other
things. Or suggest movies to us, or visit the sites of our guests like
Patty's got some stuff doing.
LibertyWeekly.net. And the last two summers, we did a summer series with you each year, and I kind of feel like maybe, you know, we're halfway through summer now, we're maybe missing that. So I don't know if there's something we can work out, or maybe a late summer, like we'll call it, can you say this these days, Indian summer?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, I'm definitely open to that. I need more excuses to kickstart episodes of my show, because oddly enough, the last episode I did is the most downloaded episode that I have in my whole catalog. So it's very interesting. But, well, I really appreciate you guys having me on the show. I had a lot of fun tonight. And y'all can catch me at libertyweekly.net. And hopefully I'll be back. I also had a spinoff show, less formal, called Liberty Bigly, that you can find, like Donald Trump, Liberty Bigly. Shout out to, I know who gave me that, Kyle Anselone's co-host that shows up. You know who I'm talking about. I feel really
Will,
bad.
Will Porter.
I love Will Porter. And he came up with that name. So anyways, really great to join you guys. Love Will Porter. He has excellent work. That's it. Uncut Gems, masterpiece.
All right, Pat McFarland of Liberty Weekly, masterpiece. Well, thank you for joining us, Pat, and I hope you can stick around for some Kathleen Turner Overdrive, the bonus content available for the Patreon supporters. People can find the show notes and more at lastnighters.com/135. Check out Pat's work at libertyweekly.net, and we will say goodnight from last night, everyone. Peace out. All right, we're going to continue the transmission for just a couple minutes here on the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is episode 192 of the show. You can find the show notes more at actualanarchy.com/192. We went a little bit long on the last night's portion of the show, so we will be getting Kathleen Turner Overdrive in just a few moments. But I did want to just mention that there is the, and I'll direct this to you, Robert, in the history of diamond mining, especially in Africa, South Africa, it's a lot oftentimes related to the British Empire, like the Rhodes, Cecil Rhodes, I think was his name. He was a British diplomat who ran the diamond cartel in South Africa. So it was a symbol of British Empire. And then they had the cartel arrangement with De Beers, restricting supply, driving up the price. But in this movie, they show us that the mine is owned by Chinese interests. And so it's almost like a different type of imperialism, not so much military, but more economic or financial. And I think I've seen things like this related to China's investment in natural resources and extraction in places like Africa. And I'm wondering if that is viewed as imperialistic in nature, or if it's an improvement in the capital structure and thus providing value and improving the living conditions and the standard of living for people in those areas in which those investments are made. What's your take on that?
I guess it would depend on how those investments are made. Like, are these crony handouts where some company will come in and pay off some politicians to get the sweet land deal that they're not giving anybody else? You know what I mean? Or is this like an actual market where they come in, you know, justly purchase rights to the mine or purchase the land that the mine is on and invests in that way and in thus, you know, creates capital value? I don't really know the details. I would guess that a lot of the complaints would be that they're doing it in the crony way, but that's oftentimes the only way to operate. Maybe the government's sitting on these lands and they're holding them back from development. And then the only way you can get access to them to develop it is to go through some crony backdoor deal with the government payoff or something like that, because there is no legal way to do it, no market way to do it. I mean, I think I generally tend to think that most people, if given the option, would prefer a market solution, that it's going to be a cheaper way to do it. I mean, not necessarily. I mean, you could just graft one guy and then he hands it to you. But I don't know. I guess it depends on how that works out. because we're not given those details in this situation. Daniel.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think that's one of the things that we just don't have the knowledge to really be able to speak to it. But I can see how the leftist critique of capitalism being imperial in nature makes some sense. Like, you're going to militarily go, like even Smedley Butler said in his book War is a Racket, that I wasn't there on the behest of the people of the United States. I was there on the behest of General Electric and Coca-Cola and whatever, like opening up markets and things like that. So using military to open up markets in an imperialist sense. And we sort of see, like in this movie where they show the Chinese are owning it, that perhaps it's a new style of doing it, not so much militarily, but financially. But again, we don't know enough details to really.
Well, it all gets solved with property rights. You know, if the government isn't in there interfering in the market and somebody actually legitimately owns that land, then they can decide to do business with these Chinese investors or not. And generally speaking, I think they're going to prefer that investment money because everybody's going to make money off the deal. It's going to be preferable to the previous situation where it's just sitting there, not providing anything of value. So, yeah. I mean, unless they really value that land for its scenic qualities and its tourism and that kind of thing, and you want to leave it, you know, as is. But usually there's other land that can satisfy that need, where you've got this one location where you can find red opals or black opals or whatever opals are coming out of that place, or diamonds or whatever. You're going to want to take advantage of that situation because you're going to make a lot of money and it's going to improve your life and the life of all the people that you're going to give jobs to.
Yeah, I think that the nature of wasting a resource is to not use it at all, you know. So they're making use of it and putting the capital in there. So at least it's going to benefit somebody who's in that position. Now, we don't know where the money came from necessarily. And that will play a role in, like, the, I guess, the morality of the series of events that is downstream from that. But anyway, we should probably end the show there and go into the Kathleen Turner Overdrive. So I'm going to thank our audience one more time and thank Pat for being a guest, even though you didn't contribute any additional other than you being on screen and eating for this portion of the show, but that's totally fine. People can check out your stuff at libertyweekly.net. Hopefully that you will have some new episodes, new content coming out, or perhaps a special of some series with us. We'd love to have you on for that. And everyone can check out actualanarchy.com/192 with show notes and more will be readily available. And we will check out the movie next week, Alita Battle Angel. So join us next week and we'll see you guys then. Peace out, everyone. Maximum freedom.
The Chipmunks. CHIPMUNK. We're the Chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot.